I'm really excited because we're going to finally talk about Hanukkah. And in the light of talking about Hanukkah, pun intended, it's important to remember that our goals are twofold. One is to give the historical context, but that really, in my mind, is a goal in service of the primary, which is to understand the consciousness that emerges from that context. So we left off at the end of last class at the verge of the Maccabean Revolt. Right, we had this whole discussion about the emergence of the Seleucid Empire. Okay. The Seleucid is just annoying because you have to get that. The Seleucid Empire from the remnants of Alexander's Empire. We spent quite a bit of time talking about the Septuagint and its significance, and we're going to come back to that relationship between the written and oral law today. We're just going to see that, like I mentioned, that is really the primary battleground with Greece. And then we're going to need to speak about the emergence of the Hasmonean Kingdom. So I actually want to get a few historical dates, names, and events under our belts so that we can really talk about the substance. Because, of course, what's the central question of Hanukkah?
My Hanukkah.
What is Hanukkah? Right? That's how the Gemara in Shabbos introduces it. And I want you to just sit with that. What an astounding question that is.
Yeah, they don't say my Pesach.
They don't say my Pesach. They don't say my Purim, which might be a little bit more relevant, right? They don't say my anything. Hanukkah is a question, and it's a question which is not answered in the written law. Right? Hanukkah is the last of the Jewish holidays. It is the one that has no basis in the written law, to the point where the Gemara itself is not really sure what it is and has to then assert. And if you want to tell me it's just a literary style to ask a question in order to answer it, nevertheless, it's a literary style we see only relevant to Hanukkah.
What is written law?
In the whole Tanakh. Meaning even Purim gets the Megillah. Although, in another context, I would make an argument that the Megillah's intentions are, I think, much, much higher than simply to give us a description of events, it being the crown jewel of the Tanakh. But that's for another time. Okay, so the turning point we've reached is that in 167, we saw that Antiochus Epiphanes, right, the king of the northern Greek kingdom, the Seleucid kingdom, the Syrian Greeks, places an idol in the temple, right? He makes a declaration that all the peoples of his kingdom should be as one. And it's important to note that this is, in many ways, a nationalistic continuation of the general Greek policy of cultural conquest. This is a new phase of conquest. Historically, all the conquest in this region has come from the east, or from Egypt, and there was no interest in making everyone the same. Right, the Eastern Empires, by definition, were amalgamations. Right, that's why in the Megillah, Ahasuerus rules over 127 nations, and the Megillah goes out of its way in many places to say each one according to his own language, each one according. Like, what is that? What's that emphasis? Well, it has a lot of depth in the Purim story, but also on a simple level, it's teaching you something about the Eastern Empires, that they were amalgamations. There was one person who was in charge, and he had all kinds of various political factions and countries, etc., underneath. The Greeks used a similar model. They weren't trying to make everyone Greek, but they were a cultural juggernaut, right? Not necessarily always consciously. Part of it was simply that Greek culture was very appealing, and it was a high classical culture, and we saw it was very appealing to the Jews. We were sucked right into it. At the same time, now Antiochus is using culture as a political tool, something which we're very familiar with. That's why I said a nationalist. In nationalism, which we'll discuss, please God, next year, we'll see that the idea of a uniform culture as a uniting factor within society is a given in nationalism. Usually expressed in what? What aspect of culture?
Language.
Language, absolutely. Right? And that's why the discussion of the translation of the Torah into Greek last week was so dominant of our discussion. So, he puts the idol in the temple. Right, many, and of course, who allows him to put the idol in the temple?
The high priest.
The priests, because the priests have become the backbone of the Hellenist camp within Am Yisrael, right? These are the people who want to be Judeans, but they don't necessarily want to be what we think of as Jews. Right? They have a national religion, but they want their culture to be Greek. Jason tries to create a polis out of Jerusalem. He wants it to be called Antioch. He builds a gymnasium where, you know, the Greek games and idol worship are taking place right in the middle of Jerusalem. Yeah.
Two small questions. One, is there any historical reference to other areas outside of Judea that, like, weren't so happy with the way that the Greeks were...
On the contrary, everyone is astounded, and one of the things which will brand the Jews as the Jews in the mind of general culture is we're the people that refuse to see the wisdom of joining the bandwagon.
Okay. Secondly, can you just address, like, what in the world is it possible, like, the priests in a religious institution are like, yeah, we'll do the idol thing?
Well, you know, it's not so clear that the priests bring the idol in. It's just that they open the door, so to speak, by asking for Greek culture. It's Antiochus in the end who decides, like, no, this temple will be a temple like every other. And particularly, it's an idol of whom?
Zeus.
No, himself. Yeah. In the beginning, it's an idol of himself. Right? Which we're going to see this repeat itself with Caligula.
Wow.
Right? Which is something that the Romans actually end up adopting from the Greeks. But that's a discussion for later, because with Caligula, it actually has much bigger consequences.
So that the ruler is...
The Greek model of kingship was a divine model of kingship, something which the Romans never held. Yes, similar to the pharaohs. Something which the Romans never held, and which crept into Roman culture in the end of the days, because whatever, we'll get to that when we get to Rome. Okay, let me just stop short there, because I want to do what we have planned today. But the critical piece for us is there are some priests who refuse to accept this shift. Right? And one well-known, although at the time insignificant, group of priests, a family, is the Hasmonean, house of Hashmonai. Right? Matityahu and his five sons say, you know, Jerusalem is not a place for a good Jew anymore, certainly not for a good priest. And they move to Modi'in, which is apparently where their family was from. They move out to Modi'in, thinking, well, we'll just stay out of this whole battle. But Antiochus, in his desire to unify all of Judea under his culture, is sending out emissaries to build altars and to get people to sacrifice, particularly pigs, upon those altars. Right? And the Book of Maccabees tells the story like this. Right? That they come to Modi'in, and they summon all the people together, and they say to Matityahu, you're an important person here. You're a community leader. We will make you friend to the king, which is actually a political status within Greek culture, which has many, many benefits. We'll make you friend to the king if you are willing to sacrifice here now before all these people, because they're not stupid. If you can get the priest and, you know, and head of the household to do it, so most of the people will probably go along, right? If you get some schlepper to do it, so then everybody's going to argue. So Matityahu says, no way, and he's arguing in the middle of this town square, picture it, right? And along comes a Jew, steps forward and says, I'll sacrifice it. And what happens? He reaches for the knife and the pig, and Matityahu either grabs the sword out of the soldier's hand, depending on which version of the story you read, or he has his own weapon somehow. He jumps up, he kills this foolish Jew, raises his hand and says what?
Mila
Shemelai. Mila Shemelai, which is, of course, a quote from earlier when Moshe rallies the tribe of Levi against what's in? The golden calf, the origin of mistaken worship in Am Yisrael. Mila Shemelai, and they flee for the hills, and this is the beginning of the Maccabean Revolt. We're going to get to its next stage in a second. Yeah?
So the story you just told, that's in the book of...
Maccabees, in the first book of Maccabees. Which, by the way, I did upload selections from the first and second book of Maccabees to the class folder for those of you guys who want to see these sources on the inside. We're not talking about Rome. We're talking about Greece. Talking about Greece. No. That was the Etruscans. We can talk about that when we get to Rome. The critical piece to take away from this is who is the first casualty of the Maccabean Revolt?
A Jew.
Right. And for those of you who haven't thought about it, or maybe if you're well-educated, you're aware, right? We all grew up thinking, who is the enemy in the Maccabean Revolt?
The Greeks,
right? We drove out the Syrian Greeks. It's not true. The story of Hanukkah is a story of civil war. It's a story of a cultural battle between Jews, a group of whom are Hellenists and want to be part of the Greek cultural world and are willing to sacrifice much of their own autonomy and cultural autonomy, political and cultural autonomy, to that goal. And another group of what we would today call fanatics, who insist on being Jews. And furthermore, and this is going to become more and more relevant as we talk about the House of the Hasmoneans, when they actually create their political entity, but the spirit of the Maccabees, of the Hasmoneans, will be bound up with this notion that in order to serve God, we must have sovereignty over this piece of land. Right? And that spirit is going to emerge periodically throughout time. And of course, what group of modern thinkers look to the Maccabees as their inspiration?
Zion.
Right, the Zionists. And if you look at the symbol of the state of Israel, what is the official symbol of the state of Israel? It's the menorah with two olive branches next to it. This is the Maccabees. Right? Because the Zionists were absolutely committed to the same idea. Whether they were serving God or not is its own question. But that in order to be on the Israel, sovereignty over this piece of land was an absolute essential. Okay, so the first casualty of the Maccabean revolt is a Jew. And that should tell us, as I said, that really the struggle is intra-Jewish. And the Greeks get pulled along for their own political reasons, as we'll speak about a little bit more later. But so they head for the hills, they kill this Jew, they head for the hills. And what happens? So the Greeks aren't going to put up with this. So they decide, we're going to just hunt these rebels down. Right? And there are various groups. It's not just Matthew and his sons. Everybody else figures out that if you want to survive as a good Jew, you got to hide out. Remember that the land around Jerusalem is riddled with caves. Right? The caves and tunnels and various, right? They all began, actually, the Tanakh tells us when the construction of these caves began. Anybody know?
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, okay. Right, in the time of Gidon. Right? It says that it's in those times that they were already digging out. There's no way to think about that. You're talking about the book of Judges, which means that it's approximately, I don't know, we'll be generous and say it's like 350, 400 years after the Exodus from Egypt, right, that Jews started tunneling out this land. Yeah, because Shlomo builds the Beit HaMikdash 480 years after, so it depends on how long from Gidon to David. So it's like 350, 400. You know, look at me like that, right?
Just doing the math.
Okay, don't frown while you're doing math.
The
role that these caves will play in Jewish history is going to be periodically very significant, because when we get to the Bar Kokhba revolt, we're going to see that there were underground cities that allowed them to hold out against the Romans for years. But at this time, they fled to these caves, and the Greeks sent out troops to hunt them down. There was one group of people that the Greeks approached on Shabbat and basically said, listen, come out or come in after you on Shabbat. And this group of Jews said what? Better that we should die in the innocence of our souls than that we should violate Shabbat. Right? Why? Because the Torah says, Mechal leha mot yuman. Right? Anybody who violates Shabbat shall surely die. They said, listen, we know for sure that God condemns us to death for violating Shabbat. We don't really know what God wants us to do in terms of fighting the Greeks. Better to go with what God says, and of course the Greeks obliged them, right? Meaning that they slaughtered the entire group. Now, that is a very important willingness to die for the sake of God. And martyrdom is going to become increasingly present in the narrative of, in the formation of religion. Because that's the other piece that we need to keep our eye on today, is that this is a story about the birth of religion, and therefore, to a certain degree, the death of the covenantal relationship. Remembering that my argument was religion is a set of beliefs, behaviors, and practices which negotiate your relationship with God, as opposed to a covenantal relationship, which is a set of vessels that hold it. Right? The vessels up till now have been the Torah, the land, the temple. As these things are beginning to transform, or even some of them fall apart, right? The specificity of beliefs, behaviors, and practices, which of course is incipient in the vessels. I mean, the Torah has lots of beliefs, behaviors, and practices. It's not a black and white issue, but we'll see specifically how it's different as we go along. So they read the Torah and says, well, you can't do it. We're going to die for God. And it's the emergence of martyrdom, which is a theme within the book of Maccabees, and it's going to continue to be a theme right up until the Bar Kokhba revolt, actually through the Crusades. Matthew and his sons make a quick calculation, and they say, well, you know, martyrdom sounds interesting, but it's a bad long-term strategy for survival. You know? And they say, basically, we're not willing to fight and live now in order, we'll never worship God again. Now, this is something which much later, Shmuel, those who are familiar with the Gemara and Shabbos, Shmuel says basically that, you know, what's the law if your life is threatened on Shabbat? Right, we violate one Shabbat in order to preserve many, and that's, they point to the Torah and they say what? No. It's not what they say. V'chai b'hem. V'chai b'hem, right? They learn out from the idea that the Torah says you should live through the laws and not die by them. However, and just to do a plug now so I can remind you all, not this Motzei Shabbat, but a week from this Motzei Shabbat at the Shalev Center at 8 o'clock tonight, although I'll send out a message with the exact date, time, My father's yard site is partnered by Yeshev, and I give every year a shir in his memory, always focusing on Hanukkah, or at least for the last 5 years or so, focusing on Hanukkah, and that is indeed going to be the topic, Eid Lasot L'Shem, right? A time to act for God, right? Let's break the rules for the sake of the Creator. Yes, in English. So anyway, you are correct that his decision was to overturn the simple meaning of the Torah, and uproot the Torah in that respect in order to preserve the relationship with God. Right? And so they all say we've got to fight. And indeed, they do decide to fight. And what's really amazing is as soon as this decision is made in the Book of Maccabees, out of the woodwork comes this group of Hasidim. Now, don't picture people with shrimals and kapotas. Right? We don't know who they are. But their absolute devotion and piety to God is combined with apparently their effectivity as a fighting force, because they join Matityahu and his sons, and suddenly the Maccabean revolt really gains ground. And they fight their way straight into Jerusalem. These Hasidim, nobody knows who they are. The academics are split everywhere from just Pshuto in its simple meaning, they're just a bunch of pious people. Some people say that they are the Hasidim, are actually the Essenes, who we'll speak of if you're familiar with, right? That they're the precursors of this sort of mystic, right, ascetic group of Jews, or perhaps, you know, we're going to get to that discussion. Some people actually say that they're the beginning of the whole Pharisaic rabbinic movement. So, whoever they are, it's their commitment and devotion that, combined with the Maccabees' leadership, allows them to drive straight to Jerusalem. And in 165, only 2 years after the idol is placed there, and according to the Book of Maccabees, on the same day, what day do they get into Jerusalem and recapture the temple?
25th
of the ninth month. 25th of Kislev, right? In case you guys don't know, it's coming up, right? They drive into the temple, liberate the temple, and then the war is over, right? Wrong. Right? It's often missed in the way we celebrate Hanukkah that the liberation of Jerusalem is the beginning, not the end of the war. They've got a good 20 years, maybe even 25, depending on which historian you go to when Shimon is declared Nasi. It's anywhere from 147 to 140, right? They've got a good 20, 25 years of fighting the Greeks. And I'm not going to go into it. It's incredible. Like, there are whole books written on all the political machinations and the military
did
tactical.
They really have elephants.
They really did have elephants. Yes, the Greeks really did fight with elephants as a the ancient tank, right? And you can imagine that it was quite effective.
Versus a donkey.
Versus people on foot. What's important for me is that the goal was Jerusalem, because Jerusalem was the heart of their culture, because their goal was to return the worship of God to its proper state. Now, my Hanukkah. Right, what is Hanukkah? Because they're going, they're fighting their way to Jerusalem, they break their way to Jerusalem, they manage to isolate the Acra, which, I don't know if you guys know, is a Greek fortress that had been built to dominate Jerusalem and prevent the Jews from ever recapturing it, which had been hidden from archaeologists up until literally a month ago, where they finally uncovered it at Ir David.
Cool.
Yeah, I just saw it with my friend the other day. If you like archaeology, I highly recommend it. Good Hanukkah,
it's a
pre-Hanukkah trip.
It's Greek.
It's Greek. It's massive.
You can go now. It's open to see.
It's open. It's part of the excavations in the old Givati parking lot.
Seems like a funny place to put a fortress since Second Temple. Jerusalem is up the hill from there. You want to have a fortress protecting it.
No, don't forget, we're in early Second Temple. This is before Herod built the Temple Mount.
I still thought Second Temple Jerusalem was
they built it on top of Ir David, where there was not a city, where only the poor and desperate lived.
Right.
So they built it there, but it dominates the temple. The key is they wanted it to dominate the temple. And whatever, that's one of the reasons, by the way, that nobody could ever find it, because they made your assumption. And then in Ir David they dug. I don't want to get into the archaeology right now. But here's the key. They drive their way into the temple, and we have one approximately primary source in the Book of Maccabees about what happens. We have Josephus, who writes about 230, 240 years later. Josephus writes Antiquities in about 80 of the Common Era. Then we have a series of rabbinic sources beginning in the Midrashim and working all the way through the Gemara, on what exactly happens there. But before we get there, we need to speak about religion. The Greeks, in response to this rebellion, or as a cause to the rebellion, and that's a big split amongst historians. Like, who started with the Jews being rebellious and Antiochus said, well, therefore I'm going to destroy your religion? Or did Antiochus say, I'm going to destroy your religion, and therefore the Jews rebelled. This is an argument which will return when we see the Bar Kokhba revolt. And you can imagine that there's a whole narrative behind this. What does the narrative boil down to? Who started it? Were we just minding our own business and the Greeks came along and tried to crush us? Or were we this rebellious people, the Greeks were just trying to manage their empire and these Jews just keep popping up and, oh well, we just got to get rid of their Judaism. Right? Because remember, that's what I pointed out to you, that the Greeks were the first culture in this region, at least. Don't know what was happening in the Mayans world or anyway, right? Who decided that cultural domination was the way to achieve political domination, as opposed to the model of Eastern empires. So, okay, what are the Greeks outlaw? Guys, you all educated?
Shabbat.
Circumcision. Circumcision. Rosh Chodesh, the sanctification of the moon. And?
Torah learning.
Specifically Torah Shabbat Peh. Because don't forget, the Greeks, right, the Greeks actually funded the translation of the Septuagint, of the Greek translation of the written Torah. That they had no problem with. It was specifically the Torah Shabbat Peh. Now, furthermore,
how do
you outlaw Torah Shabbat Peh? Well, there's two ways. You shut down the Bate Midrash, and you kill all the rabbis. This is a pattern which will repeat itself, right, to the point in the Roman era, which will have much greater consequences. Now, why these things, really briefly? Shabbat, Milah, Rosh Chodesh, and Torah Shabbat Peh. Shabbat, why?
It's our glue.
We can speak midrashically, we can speak all metaphorically and poetically. Think simpler. Most people in the ancient world have no idea what day of the week is in any meaningful sense. Right? There may be market days.
Market days.
But those don't have an intrinsic meaning. Those are just because it's market day. Right? One of the powers of Shabbat is that it's an assertion that sanctity is built into the fabric of creation. Right? The first place that the word kadosh is used in the Torah is in relationship to Shabbat. Therefore, all other Kedusha, to some degree, at least linguistically, is referential to Shabbat. Which is why you get such beautiful Chassidish Torahs about Shabbat as the source of all holiness. Brit Milah, we spoke about last week, was a fundamental conflict with Greek culture because Brit Milah represents the idea that we are partners in the completion of creation. Right? As opposed to the Greeks who believe that creation as is what is. And that the only thing you can do to creation is mar it, right? So that they saw circumcision as self-mutilation, an argument which is returning today, right? Because the impetus of Greek culture at this period was a materialist culture, is that there's nothing outside, that the task is to know the world as it is, right? And therefore, the idea that, like, why are you circumcising us? Well, God told me that this is the way things should be. What does that mean? God came somehow from outside, some divine transcendent vision, and told you to change what is?
Wait, but what's the difference between that and, like, serving Zeus?
Well, don't forget, the Greeks at this point, at least the driving impetus of their culture was the philosophical, not the mythological. I mean, you know, the average person out in the streets was just serving their gods, and there was a cultural, you know, war for resources we'll speak about when we get to the kingdom of the Maccabees. But I'm talking about who makes the decision to outlaw these four things. Somebody knew enough about Jewish culture to make the decision to outlaw these four things. Presumably, who was it, by the way?
Jews.
I mean, the Hellenist Jews would have been the ones that the Greeks would have looked to and say, well, what's the backbone of this Jewish culture that you're going to outlaw? And notice what they've also done. This is the first step on the way to the formation of religion. Because the Hellenists are going to remain Judeans, geographically. They're going to maintain their worship in their national temple, because everybody sacrifices. Every culture of the world at this point is sacrificing. But what are they going to do? They're going to strip away these beliefs, behaviors, and practices that prevent them from being like the Greeks. This is the first major step in the formation of religion. It's an argument about who's a Jew, but not in the way you're used to it. Today, when we argue about who's a Jew, it's about, well, you know, can we include you in the fold? Then they were arguing about, don't include me in that fold. Oh, those guys, they keep Shabbat, Brit Milah, and sanctify the moon. Why the moon?
For the holidays.
Right? Because if, the moon...
taking part in creation.
The moon is a parallel to Brit Milah in the sense that we sanctify time.
The moon? Come on, the sun is what determines...
Greek culture is much more interested in the sun also as a power. But don't forget that the sanctification of the moon is what allows us to bridge two worlds. Right? That there are solar calendars in the world. That's the Christian calendar today, or the the American Western culture calendar. There's a solar calendar, which follows the seasons. There's a lunar calendar, which the Muslim world today follows. That's why Ramadan migrates its way backward through the seasons, because it's a purely lunar calendar. The innovation of the Torah, I think we spoke about it at a certain point, right, is that the two are combined in order to take the sort of eternal cyclical nature of the seasons and add to it a certain intentionality. Like, we're going to go from one month to the next month as we're progressing through the year. We're not just returning upon ourselves. Right? And that's why what holiday is bound up with the sanctification of the moon?
Passover.
Right, which is the holiday of redemption. It's the assertion that history is not some endless cycle, but they're actually going somewhere. And that's what the moon represents. So the Greeks are saying, you're not going anywhere. Right? Greek culture, one of the things they want to fight is this Jewish notion that we're actually going somewhere. A lot of Greek culture, there are other elements, but a lot of Greek culture is about this cyclical nature of time or the descent, that once we were in the classic era, now we're like on our way down. Christianity will be the ones that pick up the progressivist notion from Judaism and inject it into Western culture. But we'll speak about that when we get there. So, and then the Torah Shebaal Peh. You know, the Midrash Bereishit Rabbah says the Greeks forced the Jews to write on the horn of an ox, "You have no portion in the God of Israel." Ein lechem chelek b'Elohei Yisrael. You have, what does that mean, chelek? What's a chelek in the Torah? It's a portion of what?
Land.
Oh, good. Right? The chelek Hashem Amo. Right? That God is Israel's portion in the world. And God is our, sorry, Israel is God's portion in the world. And God is our portion of creation. Kol Yisrael Yisrael chelek. All of Am Yisrael has a portion in the world to come. Your portion is the context within which you live. It's where you stand. And the whole argument the Greeks are making is, listen, live in reality. Oh, you got this revelation? Fine. But that was 1,000 years ago. 1,500 years ago. I'm not doing that right now. Right? But the idea that your decisions today are still articulating the vision of a people, right, of God and the world, an ongoing revelation, which is what the Torah Shebaal Peh is, that's ridiculous notion. Give it up. Join our culture. Now, you remember last week when we spoke about the Septuagint, I gave you this list, right, that there is basically, right, a sofer, a sipul, and a sefer, even though I also said there's, by the way, a sapir here. Let's not forget that, although we're not discussing it now. Right? There's an author, there's a story, and there's a book. And what's that book in Jewish tradition? The Torah. And the Greeks were down with this, and they wanted to translate that and say, great, we've got God's story. But the key is that the oral Torah, and I pointed out that there's a reader, right? Actually, I realized I should have written it better. Because you know what the argument of the oral Torah is? Is that what's the last level of this? The Misaper. Mm-hmm. Because even though there's a Sofer and a Sipur and a Sefer, who's telling this story? We are. We're telling the story. It didn't end when the book got written down. The whole argument of the Oral Torah is, and not, by the way, we're just reinterpreting it to our convenience, and therefore that this level is somehow detached, right? Because if it were just a bunch of like interesting thoughts or interpretive applications, right? That's why people have a tendency to disparage the rabbis, because that's what they say it is. The priest's like, okay, this is reality. You want to tell your story, Jew? Be my guest, right? But it's not divine. The whole assertion of the Torah Shebaal Peh, which is why the Greeks wanted to wipe it out, is no, it is actually the most divine part of this. Why? Because God does not exist above and beyond the world only. He also exists within the world. Where does God exist within the world? Chelek Hashem Amo, right? Am Yisrael is God's portion in the world. How does that look? Well, we're telling the story. When Matityahu and his sons make a decision, oh, it says in the book, Mechalel Yomot Yumah, those who violate it shall die. You know what the Greek mind says? Die. I mean, if you really believe God says Mechalel Yomot Yumah, you have no option. That's what it is. You know what the Jewish mind says?
What
is God telling me right now? It's true. God wrote that then. And it's absolutely true. It is universal. But it has to be within the context of what is God telling me right now. Because God cares as much about what's happening right now as he did about what was happening on Sinai. And that's a very important assertion. I'm going to say it again. God cares as much about what's happening to me right now as he did about what was happening for Moshe at Sinai. It's true they're going to take different forms. And there is something to be said for not being Moshe, right? Or for accepting the fact that I'm not Moshe. Nevertheless, the whole assertion of what it is to be Am Yisrael is it doesn't stop at the Sefer. And in fact, that if you detach the Misaper, and you just have a Sefer sitting on your shelf there, translated into whatever language is convenient to you, what happens to it?
It gathers dust.
It dies.
But it can also be, to a degree, a belief or an assertion of the Torah Sheva Al Peh is that it it's revealing of something that's embedded within the written. I mean, it's not like there was that what God cared about in terms of the Sefer and Moshe historically on Sinai, and we're doing something that God cares about me, and it's like there's a disconnect there. But rather, when it's saying, oh no, it says Bechai Behem, Velo Yemot Behem, it's saying, no, it's there.
So
I am revealing something that is embedded in...
Embedded where? In the text? Or in the teller? Where does this Misaper come from? Where does it come from? Where does Jews come from? You can't just waltz up. By the way, say, you know, what's the din of a non-Jew that tries to articulate the Torah Sheva Al Peh? Death. I'm going to get into the weather. Oh, and this is it. I'll go one step further. Yeah, you can actually, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it. You could read that. I'll go one step further. It's not embedded in the book. It's embedded in the people because they came from the book. Right? These people emerge from the story and turn around and begin to tell it. This is a true oral culture. And you are correct that it's not bringing something from the outside in. It's allowing... They are the context for the book, right? There is no text without reader. If there were no people, the Torah would not exist.
Right, but that's something that was true, as you said in your earlier, like from the time that Moshe started telling it.
Absolutely.
Meaning Moshe's the Misaper as well.
Oh, certainly. Like I said, when does this process begin? As soon as Moshe comes down off the mountain and Yehoshua says, ooh, what'd you get? Right? As soon as he has to tell anyone, then this process begins. Right, but I want you to understand why this is so important. Is because, and that's why the turning point of the whole Maccabean story, in my opinion, is when Matityahu and his sons look and say, "Yeah, that literalist interpretation, that's going to get us nowhere." What does God want from us right now? We're not afraid to be the people of the book in this moment, and not assert, "Well, you know, Emaso, what are you going to do? We got to live. I know the Torah says this, but we'll do the best we can." That's not what they say. They say is, we are the Jews. God gave us this Torah. We're not going to compromise over it. But look at the situation we're in. What does God want? I mean, see, that's the vice that we're meant to live in. Because you have to live within an absolute commitment to the Torah and an absolute commitment to God's presence in present reality. And that's what the Torah Sheva Al Peh emerges from. This dialogue between me as me and me as a product of the book.
So here's a historical question.
Uh-huh.
The teaching there of live from it and don't die from it, that wasn't a revealed teaching earlier? Meaning...
We don't have it articulated earlier.
This is the first articulation of
it? And the rabbis turn a blind eye to this articulation, by the way. Because if you ask a Jew today in yeshiva, you walk into any yeshiva in town, and you say, where did we learn the idea that the army, provided they're willing to admit the army is anything to be thinking about, right? You go into one of the Hesder Yeshivot today. And you say, where did we learn the idea that in the army that you're allowed to you're actually allowed to fight on Shabbat? Or in general, go into any Shabbat, where did we learn that Kuach Nefesh Dochet HaShabbat, that saving life, you know, pushes aside Shabbat? What are they going to tell you? They're going to quote that Gemara and Shabbos to you. L'chai Behem. Well, that's very nice, but how come you don't know the Book of Maccabees? Why the Apocrypha? And this is exactly you failed right into my trap. Right? Okay, let's talk history for 1 second. There are technically speaking, two books that really deserve the name of the Book of Maccabees, and there are three, maybe four others that get schlepped along in it. The first Book of the Maccabees is, we're fairly confident, was originally written in Hebrew, although it the Hebrew, which is spoken of by Greek sources, but we have no copy of the Hebrew book. We have it only in Greek. The second book, by most accounts, also from a sort of a critical literary analysis, is actually written in Greek. Right? They deal with roughly the same events, although they have fairly different aspirations. And they're likely written down about the first century before the Common Era, so a good 60 to 100 years after the events.
Sorry, Joshua fought on Shabbos. That's when Jericho was schmeisted, right?
Okay, tell the Shmuel.
Yeah, but that, even if that were true, that's still Midrash. It's not shot.
What do you mean by...
No, it's not. It's 7 days.
7 days.
7 days, and you can't do anything about it. 7 days in the shot. 7 days.
Oh.
But apparently the answer there was, Joshua was a Navi, God was telling me exactly what to do, you can't necessarily learn from
that. What do you mean by tell it to Shmuel?
When Shmuel, the Gemara on Shabbos, has to come up with some source of why Pekuach Nefesh is Dilch Shabbat, he points at B'chai B'hem. He doesn't point to Yeshua, he doesn't point to the Book of Maccabees, he doesn't point anywhere else. But my point is, why didn't they know the Book of Maccabees? I mean, they didn't. The Book of Maccabees was around... In the early to throughout the second temple period, but it gets put like Hannah said, it's the Apocrypha. What does that mean? It's the Apocrypha.
These books that we decided not to canonize into the Tanakh.
Correct, and there's lots of them. And when we get further into this discussion, we're also going to speak about the Pseudepigrapha, right? And
the Apocrypha book.
There are collections of Apocrypha for sure. And the Dead Sea Scrolls have completely revolutionized our understanding of the process of canonization and what versions, as we were speaking about in this with the Septuagint last week, what versions of things are actually being told. Now, why does any of this matter? Because my Hanukkah. Remember we were right about to go back into the temple and I jumped you back to this question of religion. Okay, here you are, you're with the Maccabees. You just made this decision as Matityahu was a tremendous revolution in religious thought. The first one we see explicitly. Because they remember, they weren't learning from Yehoshua. There was a whole group of Jews who decided, Mechala, Mo Yimah. Okay, Yehoshua, Yehoshua. It says in the Torah, you don't violate Shabbat. Matityahu turns the tables. The Hasidim come out of the woodwork. They get this religious fire. By the way, it also says they go out in the hills and they forcibly circumcise all the Jews that had refused. Forcibly. It says forcibly, right? And meaning that the Maccabean revolt is a religious revolution against the Jews who had joined Hellenist camp. The Greeks got involved because of one thing. Because this annoying province of Judea sits right on the fracture line between the northern Seleucid Greek kingdom and the southern Ptolemaic kingdom. If it had been off somewhere else, nobody would have cared. It would have just been a bunch of Jews fighting about whether you can do some minor surgery or not. Right? Don't forget that I pointed out to you that the geographic position of the land of Israel plays a critical role, and the spirit of the Maccabees is bound up with this irrational thought that in order to serve God, you have to dominate this geography. Sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, and it gives significance to the cultural battle they're having. Suddenly they're bound up with what becomes the fundamental cultural battle with the world culture of Greece, which gives birth to what religion? Well, two. Judaism, which nobody really cares about. But what other one?
Christianity,
which suddenly takes this whole struggle to the world. Okay, so there you are with the Maccabees. The Hasidim have joined you. You're on fire. You forced all your fellow Jews to get in line. You march on Jerusalem in a series of fairly impressive victories. You know, and you liberate the temple. You clean it all out. And what do you do? You light the menorah. Right, there wasn't enough oil. You guys all know the story. You search for this one jar which has the stamp of the high priest on it. Wait a minute. What did we say about the high priests in the last several generations?
Yeah, he's dirty, dirty.
They were like the beginning of the problem here. Interesting. Okay. So anyway, we're going to ignore that problem, right? You find this jar of oil and you light the Hanukkah candles and right, we all sing Ma'utzur and it's great.
No.
So that story appears where? Earliest source of that story is the Gemara, although it's also the Skolion, the commentary on what's called Megillat Ta'anit. Megillat Ta'anit is a list of days from the Second Temple period where it's forbidden to fast or eulogize. It's the oldest complete Ta'anitic record we have, and it's just a list of dates, but there's a Skolion written in Aramaic, a commentary around it, to explain what each of these dates are. And there in the Aramaic, it explains basically word for word what you've seen perhaps in the Gemara and Shabbat, which is that, you know, on the 25th of Kislev, Nichnasu Leichal, they went into the palace and they cleaned all out. You know the story. Okay. What about the Book of Maccabees? That's the closest to a primary source we have. And what about Josephus? Now, in context of Josephus, I should point out that Josephus goes out of his way to glorify the Hasmoneans. He even claims descent from the house of Hasmoneans, and therefore he has every incentive to dramatize the events here. Now, you can probably tell what I'm driving at. The Book of Maccabees does not mention the miracle of the candles. It says that the Hasmoneans went in, that indeed they created a menorah out of barzelim, basically like wooden, metal stakes or spears. It's not really clear exactly what it means there. And that they celebrated what holiday? Sukkot. Because if you think about it, right now we're about approaching Hanukkah. What was the last holiday we just passed? Sukkot. Right? And they had not been able to celebrate it. Why not? Because the temple was dominated by the Greeks. Oh, there's the whole, all the sacrifices. Well, how many days?
Seven days of sacrifices.
Yeah.
So it's an eight-day cycle. Interesting. Sounds familiar. Eight-day party. Okay. The relighting of the candles, and that's it. That's the Maccabees. And by the way, Lehodot Ulalel, right? To sing praises is very central to returning the praises of God to the temple. Josephus does call it the Festival of Lights, which means that by approximately 250 years later, lighting candles or some lamps.
So the menorot that they made out of Barzelim, it's not the four menorot in the Ezrat Nashim that they lit?
The shot in the Book of Maccabees is that all the temple kelim were tameh, and that they didn't have the gold or the time and energy to remake a proper menorah, but they wanted to start the service again. And part of the service in the temple is the menorah. So they made a new menorah.
Yeah, but they can't just make a menorah out of metal.
Apparently they can. Or apparently they did.
Well, I mean, if they're okay, so.
I mean, this is, again, the book of Maccabees tells it this way, and one of the things that we should be very careful as religious people, as opposed to people driven by the presence of God, is to think that, you know, one of the problems with religion being so rule-oriented, and it's increasingly true in our era, is there's very little room for failure or flexibility. I mean, if you took a bunch of religious Jews and you put them in the situation of the Maccabees, they would say exactly what you said, which is, can't do it.
Oh, because there's a pasuk from Tehillim that says everything that was revealed to David. Yeah.
And they would say we can't do it for any number of reasons. Lots of reasons. Mikcheh. Echad, right? The menorah is supposed to be one single piece of gold. All these reasons. You know what the Maccabees probably said? Okay, but we're gonna start this process again. We're starting this process again. By the way, where did they learn this from? Hizkiyahu is a great example, right? Hezekiah the king, when he wants to have a national revival, he focuses on what holiday? Pesach. Right? And he does the description of in the Pshat, I'm not talking about the rabbinic, you know, the description of what he does in the Pshat is he does the best he can. He gets together with everyone and says, we're not going to make it in Nisan. We need to push it off a month, right? Fine, we'll do it on the 15th of Iyar. And then he says, well, and you know what? Most of the people who came down from Ephraim and Manasseh, they're not Tahor. They're not actually pure enough to eat from the Korban. And you know what he does? He prays to God to forgive them and realize we're trying to do the best we can. That's in Pshat. If you look from the 29th to the 31st chapter of the second book of Chronicles, Divrei Yamim, it's amazing. You see him say basically something which a religious personality today could almost never say, which is, God, we're doing the best we can, but it's for you. And that's what the Maccabees do. And they re-begin this process. Josephus already is calling it the Festival of Lights. It waits to the sages to reveal to us the hidden light of Hanukkah. Now, many people in the intellectual community today like to claim that such a thing never happened. If it had happened, then we should have heard about it in the Maccabees. Or surely Josephus should have told us. You know, why did it have to wait? And they'll come up with all kinds of reasons. It's true that the rabbis are not going to love the Hasmoneans. We're not going to speak about it this week. But next week we'll talk about the descent of the Hasmonean kingdom and the split with the rabbis. Right? And I think there's a lot to be discussed there. And we will discuss it when we come to the descent of the Hasmonean kingdom. But what's important to me is right here. is you realize is that that attitude is a continuation of the Greek attitude that wants to separate the person who tells the story from the story itself. It didn't really happen because it's not written down. What is the story of the Hanukkah lights? You know, when Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen finished the Mishkan and the Midbar, what was God's sign that their job was well done? Right, he rains down fire from heaven. When Shlomo HaMelech finished building the Beit HaMikdash, what was God's sign that it was a job well done?
Fire.
So you could picture the Maccabees, after having made this incredible decision, charging into Jerusalem, clearing out the temple, setting up the altar and going... starting to jump up and down. Like, where's the fire from heaven? Now, what would a religious personality do at that point? Collapse. We must have failed. By the way, we see with Aaron, and we can look in the Midrashim around Aaron, and his, he was convinced that you know that it didn't happen right away. It didn't, you know, and Moshe has to console him. I don't know how familiar people are with Rashi brings. You know, so we can see already Rashi is well aware of the dangers of the religious personality. By the way, you can see it throughout his writings. Right? And you know what the Maccabees did? So maybe you need to jumpstart this process. And what's really amazing is there in the second book of Maccabees, which I uploaded to you guys, is a story about Nehemiah. Because you know what no one ever really discussed is how did they relight the fire on the altar at the beginning of the Second Temple? Because there are all kinds of rabbinic perspectives that the fire on the altar was from God and never went out. Where did it go when the temple was destroyed? So there in the beginning of the second book of Maccabees, there's a story that Jeremiah, when he knew that the destruction of the Second Temple was imminent, he hid the fire away. And then at the beginning of the Second Temple period, when the people came back, Nehemiah had a tradition of where it had been hidden, and he sent some of his servants to search it out, and there in some chamber, untouched by the destruction of the temple, they found a jar, and in that jar was the hidden fire. You know what it looked like? A viscous black substance. And it says there in the book of Maccabees that they took this black substance at the command of Nehemiah and they spread it on the wood of the altar. And when the sun shone forth, the wood burst into flame and oh, fire from heaven. Now, someone looking from the outside, wanting to see the proof, might be a little bit skeptical that this fire came from heaven. It wasn't just some black, viscous petroleum product that he'd found in a jar under the temple. But that's only if you look at a reductionist taking apart this sort of pedantic, literalist, factual approach to history that we've said that the sages were never interested in. Because the reality is, the fire begins there, and the Second Temple stands for 420 years. And not only does it stand, but it serves as a vessel for the shaping of the oral Torah, which will be the future of the Jewish people. We would not be having this conversation right now if Nehemiah had not been willing to reach there and restart the process. So, my Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah? Is Hanukkah about the battle between the Seleucid Greeks and the Jews? Well, we've seen not so much. Not so much. The Greeks get dragged in, but really it's a struggle between the Hellenist camp and the anti-Hellenist camp within Am Yisrael, which we said is really embodied in the struggle between the Sefer and the Mesaper. Right? Is it all about what was written down? Right? Is the written record of the revelation of God all that matters, and if it's not written down, it didn't ever happen? Or is it about the fact that we are a people who are a product of this book? It's not just about the Sefer, what was written down, it's about the Misaper. Who is the personality that emerges from this book in order to tell its story in a living sense? Because remember, the assertion that we're making is that God cares as much about what's happening to me today as he did about what was revealed at Sinai. And furthermore, because what was revealed at Sinai helps me to become what I am today, that the two are really one. And when I tell this story, it's not just my version of the event. It is the story of God. So therefore, in this struggle between the Hellenist camp and the anti-Hellenist camp, and remember, we're going to speak about the fact that this Hellenist camp, which is, as we saw, rooted in the priesthood, will become the people later known as the Sadducees, right? Who, of course, their great division with the rabbis will be what? Right, over the power to dictate the oral law. So my Hanukkah. The Book of Maccabees says it was a celebration of Sukkot, and I think we should take that quite seriously. It was a return to the temple, lehodot ulehalel, to sing praises to God. Right? Josephus says it's the festival of light. We see already that there is some element of light in there, and it waits for the sages to reveal to us the hidden light of Hanukkah, which is what's Hanukkah about? Hanukkah is about the power of light to drive away darkness. And it could just be that that message needed to wait to be articulated. Because the reality is, as the Rambam taught us, we're celebrating 200 years of the return of kingship. And it might only be after the end of those 200 years, which culminate in the destruction of the Second Temple, that the truth of the Hanukkah story emerged. Because why? It wasn't necessarily about what was written down. It was about who's telling the story. What is the mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles? The mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles is Pirsume Nisa, advertising the miracle. Which miracle? Well, even when you look into the sources, it's actually not so clear. Was it the victory of the few over the many? Was it the very fact that they had the faith that there was some point of purity which remained even after 100 years of struggle against Greek culture from within? The high priest, Jason, is the one that brought the Greek culture into the center of the temple. And yet, when the Maccabees charged their way into Jerusalem, fighting their own brothers, they knew, they didn't guess, they didn't think, they didn't hope, they knew that they would find some point of purity which would help them begin the process anew. And even if that point of purity is a point of emunah, a point of faithfulness to the nature of the Jews, which they might have to actually manufacture, they might have to bring it out of themselves, nevertheless, it's a miracle. And furthermore, maybe it's a miracle of a small jug of oil that burns for 8 days. Why doesn't the story get told? Well, it waits for the people who will tell it, because it's not written in any sefer. Remember, Hanukkah is the holiday which has no book. The book of Hanukkah, the book of the Maccabees, is apocrypha. And we're going to continue speaking about this process of canonization and why things like the book of Maccabees remain outside the Bible. But it is not written down according to Jewish tradition, but it is told. You were all told the story. And I'm willing to bet that if I could get every American Jew together in one room and ask them to raise their hands if they lit Hanukkah candles last year, you would be astounded that almost every single one would raise their hand. If that's not a miracle, then what is? Do people realize that the act of lighting candles, of putting those candles in the window, is an act of identifying not just with the Sefer, with the written history of the Jewish people, but it is identifying oneself as a misaper, as someone who is continuing to tell the story. Lighting the candles in your windows is an act of assertion that the story is real. That God didn't just appear at one point in history, give us a book, and walk away. That God cares just as much about me and what I'm doing in the world today as he cared about Moshe at Sinai. Now again, there are degrees of power which are given to the vessels within which we hold this story. And this is one of the themes of this course that we're going to continue to develop. What are the vessels that can hold this story, that will continue to take a sefer, a book, and use it to produce a misaper, to produce a storyteller whose stories can change the world? So my Hanukkah is the story of Jewish history. Just like we say every year, B'yamim ha'hem, Bazman hazeh, in those days, at this time. Yeah, it happened once upon a time, but it's happening now to me as well. And if I light those candles and put them in my window, and I participate in the act of advertising the miracle, whichever miracle you want to think that it was, then you are identifying yourself as part of that story, not just as a passive part, not just as a product of the story, but as its teller. So that's what I would say. This is what Hanukkah is, and that's where we're going to stop. Next week, we'll pick up with the Hasmonean kingdom, and unfortunately, its descent, but first, its formation of a very powerful vessel, which will weld together the pieces which we'll come to know as Judaism as we head forward into history.